Hello and welcome to another episode of the NBCSports.com College Basketball Talk Podcast. It is Thursday, October 4th. My name is Rob Dosser. I have a good show on the way for you today. I was joined by my colleague at NBCSports.com, Travis Hines, to break down his preview of the American Athletic Conference that went live on College Basketball Talk this morning. In addition to that, in addition to talking about Memphis and talking about UConn and talking about Wichita State and Cincinnati and all the programs at the top of that league, we spent about 20 minutes at the open breaking down the new information that has come out as a result of the trial for Merle Code and Jim Gatto and Christian Dawkins that is currently happening in the Southern District of New York in a courtroom. So I think you are going to enjoy the conversation that I had with Travis today. As always, if you do like what you heard on this podcast, please rate, please review, please subscribe to the podcast. Any interactions that you have with this podcast and the apps that you listen to podcasts in, it really does help. It helps us in the metrics. It helps us in the rankings. It makes me look good to my bosses, and that makes me happy. And in turn, that gives you a better show to listen to. So anything you could do, 5 stars, say nice things about me, really do appreciate it. Let's get into that conversation with Travis Hines. And now let me welcome on Travis Hines, my colleague from out in Ames, Iowa. Travis is going to have a little bit of noise going on in the background of this podcast today. So, Travis, why don't you explain what's going on in your life and why you're ruining the ambiance of my podcast with your noise?
Yeah, I hate to do that, but just moved into a new house that is 120 years old, and we're not quite done with the renovations. And I have a one-month-old, so if you hear crying at any point here, she's the likely culprit. So I got hammers, I got chainsaws, I got all kinds of stuff going on, and then a potentially screaming baby. So this is going to be an interesting podcast, I think, or maybe uneventful. I don't know. It's just living in the land of uncertainty here.
Moving into a new house with a one-month-old, are you sure it's not you that's going to be crying?
I mean, it very well could be, because not only did we move into a house with a one-month-old, but we've been renovating it for the entirety of my wife's pregnancy. So I have not slept. My stress level is high. So basically, I'm a mess. We'll see how this goes. I don't have high hopes.
How much HGTV have you watched since you realized that you were buying a house that you needed to renovate?
You know what? It's about the same as before, because we watched a lot of HGTV in this house. We're big Fixer Upper fans in the Hines household. But it makes me more sympathetic, because you know, like in every single one of those shows, they're like, oh no, here are the unexpected cost increase, and it's always like, yeah, duh, of course there's cost increase. And then when it actually hits your pocketbook, that it actually hurts a lot more than when you're watching it on TV. I can promise you that. Like, it's not just a clever plot device when it happens to you.
What was the wildest turn that you've had while you've been renovating this house? Like, did you find anything crazy behind a wall that you knocked down? Did you like realize that, oh man, like termites just ate through the entire floor of one of the houses? Well, like, what was the craziest thing that happened as you were doing this?
Well, we had like 5 layers of shingles on the roof, which, like, if you know anything about roofs, is way too much, especially when you live in Iowa and like we get snow on the roof, like just from a pure load perspective. But the craziest, like, I assume you've seen the Wizard of Oz, right?
Yes.
So I bet you're wondering where this story's going.
Yeah, that was a little bit of a turn I was not expecting.
You know the shoes the Wicked Witch of the West wears that you know, you see that gets trampled?
Yes.
You know, like,
yes.
The very witch-like shoes? We found an identical shoe to that in the wall of one of the rooms. Like, it had fallen or was placed there when the house was probably built in 1900 and had stayed there for 118 years until we found it just this last spring.
That's wild.
Yeah. I don't know what the story behind the shoe in the wall is, but I bet it was interesting.
So I used to work construction during the summers when I was in high school. And there was this one time when we were ripping down, like, there was this building that was kind of like a duplex. And on one side, the guy had built a second story and had turned it into like an apartment over a shop. And the guy that was on the other side wanted to do the same thing. So we're tearing down the one side of this duplex, and we start ripping down the walls, and we realize, I think it was built in like the 1940s. And once we start pulling down the walls, we realize that somebody had, in between the two buildings, there was like 3 inches of space.
that was completely cut off from everything. And somebody had hung up pinups from mid to late 1940s Playboys all along that wall, like up 12 feet around. Like it was, the entire thing was nothing but pinups from the 1940s from centerfolds for Playboys, which was
quite. So there was definitely a 14-year-old boy that was living there in the 40s. Is what you're saying.
I don't know what it was, man, but it was like there was literally 3 inches between the two buildings where all these things were hung up. So I don't know why they put it there. I don't know who put it there. I don't know how they got it up as high as they did. But the guy that was my boss at the time ended up taking them all down and keeping them, which was a little bit disturbing. And I don't really want to know why he decided to do that. He said he was going to sell them on eBay. I don't know if I believe him.
Well, what you really don't want to know is who the people are that are buying those on eBay, I feel like. Like that's a whole new level of weird.
Yeah. Yeah, and this podcast just took a turn. So I think we should probably try to get back on track. I have you on today because you wrote our American Conference preview for NBCSports.com. We are going to dive into that. It's going to be a little bit of a different format than our other conference previews just because one-third of the AAC is not really all that relevant. And I want to make some time on this podcast to be able to talk about things other than 1940s pinups and Wizard of Oz shoes. We need to talk about the trial going on in New York and everything that is going on with that and with the larger college basketball community. So I guess let me start you off with this, Travis. Of everything that has come out so far from this trial and from the evidence that we've heard, and has there been anything that has surprised you, anything that kind of took you aback, anything that made you think, oh, wow, this is a little different than I thought it was going to go?
You know, not so much that, other than just how kind of mundane it all feels. Like when you're reading the transcripts and the reports from people who are attending the trial, I mean, it's hard to feel scandalized by what you're reading. Like people that are worth multi-millions of dollars to universities or agents or financial advisors are getting paid money. I mean, that's really this. People worth money are getting paid money is what this comes down to as the main. And it's just, it feels silly point because of NCAA amateurism rules, you know, and we can get into, you know, what exactly the legal ramifications of these, you know, people that have been indicted are and whether or not they actually committed any crimes or what the definition of the crime would be. But just reading it, it's not all that interesting. It's people getting paid. And the only reason that it's underhanded or behind the scenes is because of, you know, amateurism rules that really, you know, were antiquated half a century ago.
So what I think is the most interesting part about that is, I mean, we've talked before about whether or not this should actually be considered a crime, right? Like, I don't think it's breaking new ground to say it's kind of silly to think about how there literally is no victim in this. Like when the whole idea of this being a fraud means there has to be someone that was defrauded, which means there has to be someone that was a victim, right? And the idea that the defense is trying to paint, what they're going to argue, which I think is the smart move and the right move, because I agree with them, is that everybody got what they wanted in this situation, right? Jim Gatto, Merle Code, those guys work for Adidas. What they want, because what Adidas wants, is to have talented basketball players go and play for the basketball programs where the Adidas spends hundreds of millions of dollars to pay these schools to be outfitted in them. They sponsor these schools, so they want the players at these schools to be talented enough that these games are going to be played on TV. Like they want that kind of publicity. They want good players wearing their jerseys, more or less, right? So they want those players to go to those schools. They're willing to pay for it. They got what they wanted. Jim Gatto got what he wanted. The basketball coaches at these schools, they got what they wanted, right? Because the best way for you as a coach to further your career, to get a raise, to get a contract extension, to get a promotion, to go from being an assistant coach at Louisville to getting a head coaching job at, I don't know, Eastern Kentucky, whatever it ends up being, the way to further your career is to win. And the best way to win is to get talented basketball players. So if you are going to have Adidas paying $100,000 to get you a kid like Brian Bowen at Louisville, that could be the difference between what? I don't know, just 28 wins and 30 wins. That could be the difference between a 5 seed in the tournament and a 2 seed in the tournament. That could be the difference between getting to the Sweet 16 and getting to the Final Four. For some schools, that could be the difference between actually getting into the tournament and missing the NCAA tournament. So the coaches got what they wanted in this situation, which means that these universities themselves got what they wanted. I don't think that it's not a coincidence that, like, when schools go on these random runs through the NCAA tournament, what are all the stories we see, right? About how much publicity they got, how many more applications they're getting to the program, how many more donations they're getting, how much, you know, all this publicity was worth in terms of money that they saved, in terms of advertisements for the university. Like, the whole reason they have these athletic departments and these basketball teams and these football teams is to help give a reason for people to want to spend $70,000 a year to go to those institutions and to learn, right? It's a lot of money to go to school. If you're going to spend that much money, you better go somewhere where you're going to be able to have a good time. And so that's part of it. So the universities are getting what they want when these sports teams are good, because when they're good, they're getting that free publicity. They're getting more people coming in. They're getting more donations. They're getting alumni getting energized about going back to all that stuff. It's all good for the university when these good players get there. So they got what they wanted. The players themselves, like, who's going to say no to getting paid to do something you love to do, right? Like, there is nothing wrong with having a talent that is marketable that you can capitalize on and going out and capitalizing on it. There's no, like, what is inherently bad? What is inherently un-American about profiting off of what you're good at? Like, isn't that what our country was built on? So the players themselves are getting what they wanted. Everybody here is getting what they want. So who is the victim? Where's the crime? That is what the defense is going to argue. And where it gets really interesting to me, Travis, and you can tell me, and I can steer this back to you after I make this point, is that the people on this jury, like, they're not like me. They're not like you. They're not like the people that listen to this podcast. They're not like college football fans. They're not people that have kind of grown into this idea of amateurism being this thing and being noble and being something that we need in college sports. These are people coming into this with a blank slate that have no idea about the processes of things that happen in college basketball and, you know, why these kids who are worth like millions of dollars, some of these kids are worth millions of dollars to these universities, why they're not allowed to actually tap into any of that revenue or any of that earning potential. And that's where this gets interesting, because all of a sudden, instead of having people that are already dug in with their opinion about what amateurism means and whether or not it should be something that is acceptable in the NCAA, we are going to have people with a clean slate that have no opinion on this weighing in on whether or not they think this is something that's okay. And I think that result is going to be fascinating, because in my mind, if we were to completely tear down college sports and start it over right now, I do not think that there was anybody that would think it was a good idea to not let the kids get paid.
Absolutely. And I mean, it'll be interesting. I think the jury, I mean, I guess the question is, they're going to find what the government has found unseemly, at least, right? Like, I mean, there's like, this isn't an above board, squeaky clean business. The stuff that's going on feels unseemly because it's people making deals behind players' backs, behind closed doors. It doesn't feel particularly on the up and up, but does that make it illegal? And I'm not sure that the case is going to be able to get there. And especially for people that, you know, the only reason that amateurism exists is to prop up the system as it is. I mean, there's not really an argument for it, to your point, that if you start it over and you have a multi-million dollar business, you know, that's worth billions of dollars over the long haul, cutting out the talent is going to be a non-starter for any business plan going forward. So I'm not sure what direction this is going to go. I know it's not good for college sports one way or the other that this is the avenue that it's going, but, you know, and whether or not these guys get convicted, I think it seems pretty tenuous right now, which is kind of amazing when, you know, these federal cases have what, like a 96-98% conviction rate.
Yeah. And I mean, that's the big thing here is that the whole defense is not, they're not arguing whether or not they did it. They're arguing whether or not it's a crime. So they're basically admitting to it, right? They're saying, look, you got us. We did everything that you said we did, but we broke NCAA rules. And NCAA rules are not federal crimes. And it's silly for you to actually go out and try to enforce NCAA rules as federal crimes. I think the best line, I forget who it was. It might have been Jim Gatto's defense attorney in her opening statements. I think her name is Casey Donnelly. I don't have it in front of me. If I got that wrong, somebody let me know. She said that this is like the police or the FBI enforcing your homeowners association rules, or like enforcing the rules in your apartment building where you're not allowed to have I can't paint my doors or the front of my house a certain color in the neighborhood that I live in because of what our homeowners association rules are. And that would be like if I decided to do that, the police coming in and charging me for that. Or, you know, when I used to live in an apartment building, there were certain like code of ethics that came to what happens when you went to go and use the pool. Like, you don't go down as soon as it opens, put your towel there, and then come back at 1 o'clock in the afternoon and expect you to still have that space, you know. But that's just was one of the things that we didn't do there. And that would be like the police coming in and arresting me because I put my stuff down there at 9 o'clock in the morning when I knew full well that I only wanted to go down there at 1 o'clock in the afternoon when the sun was brightest and it was hottest and it was I could get by with drinking a beer at the pool without actually feeling like an alcoholic. So that I think that was the best line and a very good point to make about this entire thing. One other question I do want to ask you is, if the thing that I think is the biggest concern here is that, so when the NCAA made all these rule changes from the Commission on College Basketball in August, one of the things that they added in there was that they can go back in any official investigation into something involving these people and the coaches, players, AAU coaches, whatever it is. The NCAA has access to those investigations and can now use them in their own investigation and their own investigation process. And that's not something that they were able to do before, which means all of the evidence that comes out here is what they're going to be able to use when they want to go out and actually try to punish the people that were involved. But what I'm curious about, and you can give me your thoughts on this, is so part of the reason that like Miami right now does not have any, like none of their coaching staff has anybody that is facing a federal charge because they had conversations about allegedly trying to get Adidas to fund the $150,000 they needed to match the offer that Arizona allegedly made to Nasir Little, right? But the part of the reason that the Jim Larrañaga and some of the guys on that coaching staff, they're not arrested because money never changed hands and all they did was have a conversation about it. So my question to you is, and this is especially relevant with Brian Bowen Sr. Potentially testifying this week, maybe as soon as Thursday, full disclosure, we are recording this at 12:33 Eastern Standard Time on Thursday, which means that we could be recording this as Brian Bowen Sr. is testifying. So some of what you hear now may not necessarily be relevant as more information comes out and more reporting comes out over the course of the next couple hours if he did in fact testify today. But the larger point is, one of the things that was said is Oregon offered a, quote, astronomical amount for Bowen, right? But if Oregon only offered it and they had the conversations about it, then how can the NCAA actually punish them if no money actually changed hands? This was just people talking about it. Because isn't the very simple defense for Oregon going to be, yeah, we said we would do it, but we were never actually going to follow through. We just wanted to get the kid's commitment and get him on campus, and then we would deal with what we had to deal with there. We never actually committed a crime. This was just a recruiting tool. So I wonder, like, so the stuff that does come out, is it actually going to get these guys in trouble with the NCAA?
Well, I mean, like in Oregon's case, there's not even any Oregon coaches on tape offering the money, right? It's just Dawkins talking or, you know, saying that it happened, right? So it's even third party that maybe they could easily say, no, it's just Dawkins trying to get the price up from Louisville. So, I mean, like, unless there's money transactions, I think, especially if it's third parties saying that money's going, that's just gossip. There's not really anything the NCAA can do. I think they're going to need access to actual documentation of, you know, whether it's checks or bank records or whatever to make any of this stick, because otherwise it's going to be hearsay. And I don't know, unless these guys, you know, weren't dealing in cash, it seems like that would be far-fetched that there's going to be a lot of hard evidence here, unless, you know, Brian Bowen's going to open up his, you know, bank records and so on and so forth. But it seems unlikely that there's going to be enough corroborating evidence for this to really sting a lot of programs.
Yeah, I think that there's going to be a lot of smoke. I don't know how much the NCAA is actually going to be able to punish people based off of what they get. I think Silvio D'Souza, I doubt he's ever going to play college basketball again. I doubt that the Final Four banner that Kansas hung last year with Silvio D'Souza on the roster is probably not going to stay up, because we have Jim Gatto saying under oath that, you know, they gave $20,000 to somebody associated with Silvio D'Souza to get him out of money that was paid to him by Under Armour to go to Maryland so that he would go to Kansas. I think go ahead.
Well, and that's why that point that you made, like, does Kansas particularly care that that banner is going to come down, like, as an institution? And if they don't, which I assume it's not that big a deal to them, it makes it really hard to paint Kansas as a victim, as the government's trying to do here. Like, the victimhood is not, it just doesn't make any sense with just what you just said.
All right. And we're going to get into the preview for the AAC after I make two more points, which just kind of really details the absurdity of everything that is going on with this. So Kansas has been victimized by Adidas and by Jim Gatto, right? That's what everybody's saying. That's what the crime is here. Kansas is the victim of Adidas because Adidas paid money to a player that went to Kansas, and Kansas ended up playing that guy, and they may have to have a banner taken down. So that's where the fraud is. That's where the victimizing was, right? So tell me why, after the superseding indictment that came down in April that implicated Billy Preston's mother and Silvio D'Souza and Bill Self in Kansas and all those guys in this entire mess, why did Kansas then re-up on a 12-year, $191 million endorsement deal with Adidas if they were such victims?
You know, I think it just is a case that they just felt like Adidas cared too much. And how can you hold that against them, you know?
Exactly. That's got to be what it is. Here's the other part about it. Jonathan Brad Augustine, he was the AAU coach of Nazir Little, and he was the AAU coach of Balsa Capri, Kropravica is, I think, how you say the kid's name. I don't know how to say it. I'm just going to call him Balsa. 2019 five-star prospect Louisville was involved with. The reason he was arrested was because he was having those conversations and was getting money to give to the family of Balsa, and he was part of the guy that was helping to negotiate the money that Nazir Little was going to end up getting, right? Well, Brad Augustine is no longer facing charges, right? Because he said that he was never going to give the money to the player. All that money he was going to keep for himself. So he was lying to Adidas and lying to these schools and lying to everybody, and probably even lying to the FBI. But basically what he said was, I wasn't going to give the money to them. I was going to keep all that money for himself. That's an actual fraud right there, right? Like, he's lying to people to get money to profit for himself. But he doesn't get arrested because he doesn't give the money to the player that was going to the NCAA because he doesn't actually jeopardize the kid's eligibility. That is what we're looking at right here. He didn't get charged because he was going to lie and keep all the money for himself. But the guys that did get charged are the ones that made sure the unpaid labor actually got somewhere close to their market value. That's ridiculous. Think about that.
Yeah, nobody's saying this is a good system, but I think it's hard to prove that it's a wildly illegal system.
Yeah, I think we're on the same page, and I think we need to move on. Let's talk about the American Conference. Like I said, we're going to do this a little differently since the bottom third of the conference really is not all that relevant and not all that interesting. So we're going to go instead of going alphabetical order, we're going in reverse order of your rankings on the AAC preview that came out today. The bottom four, you had 12 South Florida, 11 East Carolina, 10 Tulane, and 9 Tulsa. What is interesting about those four teams? What do we need to know about those four teams? And is there any chance that you look stupid and one of those four teams ends up winning the American this year?
I don't think anyone's going to win. I guess the best bet to outperform that's Tulsa. They've got a little bit coming back, and it seems like Frank Hayes' teams always outperform their preseason expectations. But South Florida is probably going to be terrible in year two under Brian Gregory. East Carolina almost certainly is going to be terrible in Joe Dooley's return back to Greenville. And, you know, Tulane losing an NBA draft pick in Melvin Frazier and another guy in Cameron Reynolds to the NBA, it just doesn't seem like that's going to trend in an upward direction. So, I mean, there's always a chance I look stupid, like, for a lot of different reasons, but I don't think those four teams are going to be the reason why this time around.
Yeah, I think Tulsa might have a little bit more upside than you are giving them credit for. People I've talked with around that conference think that they have a chance to kind of maybe sneak up into the top half. Losing Junior Eto is going to hurt. He was their go-to guy for most of the last two seasons. You know, for the most part, it's Tulsa. And I don't know if you saw that quote from Merle Code that he tweeted out, but Tulsa is sponsored by Adidas, and Merle Code basically said, I'm never going to do anything to help Tulsa, so we're never going to do anything to talk about them on this podcast. So let's move on to Memphis. You have them at 8th. I think that might be a little bit low, so I'm going to talk about that. Penny Hardaway. He was more or less the story of the AAC this offseason as the native son of Memphis returns home to lead his hometown program back to glory. And I think if you look at the commitments that they've gotten in the class of 2019 and some of the names that they're still involved with, DJ Jeffries, who was a 5-star recruit, I think he's more close to a top 40 guy now, and James Wiseman, who is one of the three people in the mix to be the number one prospect in the class of 2019, that has everybody fired up. But I kind of understand why you're not as bullish on him this year. But you have him 8th. I think that they're probably going to be top 5, and I'm going to give you 3 reasons why. 1, FedEx Forum is going to be absolutely packed again this season. They don't have Tubby Smith there. They have a Memphis guy as the head coach. They have a whole bunch of Memphis players on that roster. The culture of that city in terms of what they're looking for out of basketball program is they want some talented, highly regarded dudes from Memphis playing for the University of Memphis. And they are going to have that again this season. Guys like Alex Womack, guys like, I'm blanking on what was the name of the other guard?
Tyler Harris.
Yeah, Tyler Harris. They have some dudes from the city of Memphis that are going to be playing for Memphis, all while there is this energy around the program that comes with Penny being in charge and being in the mix for these elite recruits. They're going to sell it out. That's going to be the toughest place in the conference to play once again this season. 2, Penny has never, I think it's little overblown, this idea that he might not be a great basketball coach and he's just kind of a figurehead. Because if his name wasn't Penny Hardaway, if we didn't know who he was, if he didn't have any like history to him as a basketball, somebody involved in basketball, he started as like an 8th grade girls JV coach or something like that. Like he's worked his way up from the lowest ranks to the highest ranks to, you know, going to the EYBL finals with Team Penny, his Nike sponsored AAU team. He won a bunch of titles with East High School in Memphis, where James Wiseman played, where a bunch of these guys that are, you know, he's recruiting all played for him at East High School. So it's not like he's never coached before. He's never coached at the college level. He's never run a college basketball program, but he's coached a bunch of very, very talented guys successfully at a high level, at least in the high school ranks. So I think the idea that he can't coach is a little overblown. But then you throw in the fact that they have Sam Mitchell on that coaching staff, a.k.a. former NBA Coach of the Year Sam Mitchell on the coaching staff, and there's plenty of X's and O's knowledge on that bench to be able to get it done with the talent that's on that roster. And my third point is I think that you are underselling the talent that they have a little bit. Jeremiah Martin is an absolute stud. I think he's got a shot to be AAC Player of the Year this year. There are a lot of guys that you could put in that conversation. I don't think it's anywhere near clear cut. Like for who? How many guys did you consider when you picked Jerron Cumberland? Right.
I picked Cumberland. I had BJ Taylor in there for about a half hour, and I stared at it before I switched back to Cumberland. And you could have gone in a couple different directions. I think I ultimately picked from a group of 4 guys. So I'm with you that it's pretty wide open.
Yeah. I think Cumberland, Jalen Adams, Jeremiah Martin, and then you could probably go with one of like 3 different people on UCF this year. Yeah. In terms of who you want. Like there's a lot of guys that could be in that conversation, and Jeremiah Martin is firmly in that mix. I think Kyron Davenport and Mike Parks are underrated as big guys. They're going to hammer the offensive glass this year. And the kids that Penny has coming in, you know, they're going to take a little bit of time. Like, we're not talking about top 15 recruits that they have. But, like, Alex Lomax is a good player. He was committed to Wichita State before he ended up going back on that commitment, decommitting and going to Memphis. He's had a long relationship with Penny Hardaway. It's where he always wanted to go. So he ended up going there. They got the Tyler Harris kid coming in. They got Isaiah Maurice, who is a JUCO transfer that started at, I believe it was Kansas State. So they have talent on the roster. They're going to be able to play a two-point guard system. They're going to be able to let some of their freshmen kind of play a complementary role alongside Martin. So I think you put all the pieces together, and to me this is a top five team in the league, especially considering the fact that there really isn't all that much talent in the conference. What did I say that was wrong? What do you disagree with?
I'm not going to disagree with you at all. In fact, if you read my preview, you probably understand why I would say every minute we're not spending talking about Penny Hardaway in Memphis on this podcast is probably a wasted minute. I'm incredibly excited to see what Penny Hardaway can do there. You've got Martin and you've got Davenport, and then those freshmen are going to be good, but the level that they're at, I just don't think that they can be impact players. And the talent level across the board in the middle of the AAC is so even that I just think, you know, I tended to lean towards experience when putting these rankings together. I think the middle will be jumbled, and you know, a lot of these could probably be wrong, but I think they'll be relatively close in terms of, you know, eight through three probably. But that's why I have Memphis where they are. I hope they're higher because it would mean Penny Hardaway is a good coach, and I think that'll be good for the sport. But I'm not sold on that freshman class as being impactful on day one.
To your point, I would not be surprised if the team that won the AAC this year had a 12-6 record in the league, and the team that finished eighth had an 8-10 record in the league. That's how close it'll probably end up being. Let's move on to number seven. You have the Temple Owls and Fran Dunphy's Swan Song. Talk to me about Temple.
Yeah, so I think the most interesting thing for Temple is that Fran Dunphy is basically doing a victory lap here for his 30-year head coaching career. He's going to be done after this year and turn the reins over to Aaron McKee of Temple fame. But I think most people probably know him from his, 13-year career in the NBA. Temple should be all right this year. You know, I think it'll be a long shot for them to try to get an at-bid NCAA tournament bid just because – I don't know how talented they are, but they do have two of the more talented guys in the league in Quentin Rose and Chiz Alston, who I think are both really good and are going to be able to win them some games in this league this year. I think just beyond those two, I don't have a lot of faith in what they have coming in. And when you look at the track record for Dunphy and Temple the last couple of years, I think it's trending in the wrong direction. And also, I hate coach and waiting situations. I think they lead to indecision. I don't think you get guys rallying around the coach on his way out. I think you get guys straddling the line of who their allegiance is to and who they should be listening to. And, you know, that's not to say that's going to happen at Temple this year. I think that's just a concern that you have to have in having a unified voice in that locker room. Do you listen to the guy on his way out, or do you try to play for the guy that's going to be deciding minutes for your next 2 or 3 years of your career? So I don't love that dynamic for Temple.
Yeah, I mean, they lose Obi and Choya, I think that's how you say his last name, and Josh Brown, who was kind of the leader for that team, and that's going to hurt. They do have they might have the best perimeter in the conference this year with Chiz Alston, Quentin Rose, and Nate Pierre-Lewis, who was an All-AACC freshman who really came on late in the season for Temple. So there is some talent there. They're going to win some games. I don't know if they're going to be able to. They'll probably pick somebody off at home that they have no business beating and lose to somebody that they have no business losing to on the road, which is kind of what Temple has done during Fran Dunphy's tenure. I think the X factor might be, so they got a kid named Trey Lowe, right, who had a pretty good freshman season for him in 2015, 2016. But in March of his freshman year, he got in a pretty bad car accident, ended up having to take an injury redshirt in 2016, 2017, and never quite got healthy enough to crack the rotation and play last year. He's a talented kid. He's 6'7". I think he adds a little bit of depth and a little bit of another dynamic to them. So it'll be interesting to see how he ends up and if he ends up playing this season. That's all I got to say about Temple. You got anything else?
Nope.
So at six, you have UConn, which is the other elite program in the AAC that is undergoing a coaching change. Obviously, Kevin Ollie lawsuits, $10 million buyouts, level one infractions. There's a whole lot going on with that program off the court in terms of what their coaching situation used to be. I'm much more interested in what the coaching situation is going to be this season. I think that Danny Hurley was probably the best coach on the market during this coaching, the 2018 coaching carousel that wasn't named Chris Mack. I have a lot of respect for the way that he coaches and the way that he runs his programs. And I think that UConn actually has a roster that makes a lot of sense in terms of the way that Hurley played. Like when he took Rhode Island to back-to-back NCAA tournaments with teams that just had a ton of talented guard play, right? And this UConn team has the guard play to actually be pretty good and pretty competitive in the AAC this year. Jalen Adams, like we mentioned, is an uber productive lead guard, a guy that I think he averaged almost 20 points a game last season. He's somebody that's going to be in the mix for AAC Player of the Year. I think that he'll be joined in the backcourt, hopefully, by Al-Tariq Gilbert, who is a former McDonald's All-American, who in like the very limited minutes that he's played in the last two seasons has been productive. Like he's 5'11", a real pest defensively, a playmaker on the offensive end. Like he's a guy that can work really, really well in the way that Dan Hurley wants to play, assuming that his shoulders stay healthy. He's had two seasons so far ruined by having to undergo shoulder surgery. So hopefully he will be back because I think he might be a difference maker. Christian Vital is another guy. He hasn't really gotten a lot of attention, but he averaged almost 15 points a game last season. So that three right there, I think, is going to be really good. But beyond that is where we kind of get into some question marks. They have Duquesne grad transfer Terrence Smith coming in. They got a kid named Sid Wilson, who used to be a top 75 recruit that ended up, he initially enrolled at St. John's, went to some summer school classes, left, transferred to UConn, sat out last season, and will now be playing this year. I think that he can kind of, in theory, fill the role that Terry Larrier played before leaving school. He might be a year away still, but he can kind of fill that four role. I think that he has the size to guard up a little bit, which will let UConn play that four guard system. And then they also have St. John's grad transfer Kasam Yakwe coming in. Really good shot blocker, but he's only like 6'7". He seemed like a really promising prospect when he was a freshman and never really lived up to some of that hype that he had over the course of the last two seasons. And he is probably like the guy that everyone is going to be talking about in the front court for UConn. Their front court just really, for a program that produced a lot of really, really, really good big men for a lot of years, they just do not have very good bigs this season. So it's going to kind of, to me, come down to whether or not those guards can live up to the hype that they have. And if they buy into and thrive in Dan Hurley's system, I think they have a chance to finish top four in the conference. I think six, though, is probably about right. I don't think they're quite as good as any of the teams that you have above them, except for Wichita State. And we'll get into that. But I think you got them right with UConn. What did I miss?
I don't think you missed much, but I do think that they have a pretty decent shot at outperforming where I've got them, especially if Gilbert is healthy and, you know, productive, as you know, you would hope a former McDonald's All-American could be, even with his injury history. I think that backcourt has a chance to win them a lot of games. But without knowing Gilbert's health situation going forward and all the problems you met, not, or questions in the front court, it was hard to slot him higher than six. But if that backcourt is healthy and productive, that's, I think, their path to finishing in that top four in the league.
I think that, I mean, this is going to be a little bit of a rebuilding year, and we'll get into it more as we keep diving into the rest of this conference. But like the league as a whole just isn't very good this year. But I think generally speaking, this is going to be a great year for the conference because UConn is coming back to relevance. And there's actually a little bit of excitement around that program from a fan base that is generally speaking very, very good and cares a lot about the UConn Huskies. I think the same thing can be said about Memphis and what's building up around that program. I think that when you look at it, having like a team like UCF come back to relevance or come into relevance for probably the first time is something that's really good for the program. Cincinnati's in a bit of a rebuilding year. So I think that having some of these programs that were a little bit under the radar for a while in terms of what they were actually being able to produce, probably because of poor coaching hires and coaching decisions, that's really good for the AAC as a whole. So while it may not generate a top 25 team this season, I think that the two biggest programs in the conference, it seems like they're coming back. Let me ask you this, Travis. UConn or Memphis in 5 years, which program is better?
Man, I'm going to say Memphis purely because I think Penny is going to get players there. I think he's going to get high level players there. And to your point, like, I think Sam Mitchell is going to be able to carry the X's and O's portion, you know, assuming Hardaway needs that as a first time college coach. And, you know, being, you know, coming out of covering Iowa State, I saw how big Bobby Lutz was for Fred Hoiberg his first year on the bench. And I think Sam Mitchell fits that perfectly. And I think, like, also, like, how crazy is Memphis's situation, where we've talked about them so much, and the thing that keeps, like, never gets mentioned is freaking Mike Miller is an assistant on that staff. Like, that should be a big story, and it's just not, because of all the other interesting things happening around Memphis. So I know I'm going off on a tangent to your question, but to go back to kind of what you said about the league as a whole, I think this is a great year for the league not to have a couple powerhouses at the top, because it's going to make UConn and Memphis, who are the most interesting teams in the league, but certainly not the best, it's going to help them hang on to relevance a little bit more this year than they would have, you know, say last year, where you had Cincy, Wichita State, and Houston kind of running the top of the league.
And I think you can probably put Wichita State in that conversation as well, because they are heading into something of a rebuilding season. You have them fifth. I think that's entirely too high. Defend this egregious ranking, Travis.
It's a bet on Greg Marshall, because there's not a lot on that roster that probably supports putting them fifth, frankly. It's a bet on Marshall and his track record, and then kind of placing a little bit riskier bet on Marcus McDuffie returning to form after a wildly successful sophomore year in the Missouri Valley Conference to a basically disastrous year for him last year in the American after an injury cost him the first few weeks of the season. Because beyond that, Wichita State loses everybody. Obviously, Landry Shamet is now in the NBA. They lost all five starters, and there wasn't exactly a ton of depth beyond McDuffie that's coming back. You know, it's going to be on Wichita State to get some production from some newcomers, you know, whether it's freshmen like Eric Stevenson or the JUCO Ricky Torres that I think was, you know, top five junior college player. Like, there's some guys here that I think fit the Wichita State Greg Marshall mold. And that's why I've got him fifth. And I wish I had a stronger take on Wichita State than that, because I think it would have been easy to put them down in that bottom four, frankly, if you really wanted to look at them with the most critical eye possible because of a lack of talent returning. But I just think the culture and the machine that Greg Marshall has built there in the state of Kansas is going to be enough to kind of buoy them through this reload or rebuild, however you want to look at it.
I think having Wichita State fifth says more about the rest of the conference and where it kind of stands than anything about Wichita State specifically.
Yeah, I mean, it's both for sure, yeah. On my end at least.
Yeah, I mean, it just, my big thing is, like, as much as I respect Greg Marshall as a coach, like, he just does not have very good basketball players on his team this year. They lost 9 of their top 11 scorers and 89% of their minutes from last season. Two of their three assistant coaches have gone on to different jobs. That's a lot to replace in a program in 1 year that isn't bringing in, I don't think they have a 4-star prospect committed, except for maybe that JUCO kid. So that's not necessarily ideal. I'm not saying that Wichita State as a program is dead. I'm not saying it was a bad decision for them to go to the AAC, but I do think that this is the year where they finish in the bottom four of the conference standings. I don't think I have anything else to add. Do you?
No, that's just so hard for me to picture, but I definitely think it's in the realm of possibility.
So you have SMU fourth. It's kind of hard to disagree with that. They were crushed by injuries last season. Shake Milton, I think he like broke a wrist or something. Is that what it was?
A hand injury, I believe.
Yeah, he had a hand injury and he missed a bunch of, like, I think like the last month of the season, month and a half. Jarae Foster, who is an NBA kind of like 3-and-D perimeter forward kind of player, tore his ACL in the middle of the season and missed the end of the year. He's like the guy that kind of makes things work for SMU in terms of their ability to play small offensively and play big on the defensive end. So getting him back to 100% is going to be really, really, really big for them and really important for them. Their backcourt is good. I think it's better than people realize with South Florida transfer Jamal McMurray and former Arkansas point guard Jimmy Witt. I don't think it's quite as good as UConn's. I don't think it's quite as good as Temple's, but they are certainly not going to be outclassed by anybody in the conference. I think that Ethan Chargeois, is that how you say his name? I can't. He's might have the most difficult name to pronounce in the conference, but he was an all AAC freshman. And again, he's another guy that just really fits what Tim Jankovic wants to do. There are two transfers that join, Nate Dixon and Isaiah Mike, that I think are going to be important, if only because they actually give SMU depth. Because beyond the six guys that I just mentioned, I don't know if there's someone that's going to end up being able to crack that rotation. So that top six is good enough for me to get them into the top four of the league. But I think that they are out of the conversation. I think the conversation for winning the conference at this point is UCF, then there's Cincinnati and Houston, then there's everybody else. And I don't think that SMU is quite to that point where you can call them like a legitimate contender for the AAC regular season title.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, I'm a big Foster fan. That's why I've got them at four. I think that's he's good, and we'll be able to step into a big role there, assuming that he's healthy.
Yeah, I'm with you. I mean, Tim Jankovic can coach. They've proved their ability to have a couple of upset wins, and I don't think that they've ever really needed to have depth to succeed. It's just, you know, it's a little bit of a concern. I don't know how good their bigs are going to end up being, but hey, you know what? In the conference this year, that might be enough to get them into fourth place. You have Houston third. Talk to me about Kelvin Sampson's group.
Yeah, so they lost Rob Gray. They lost Devin Davis, are the two big departures from last year's team. That was a Michigan buzzer beater away from going to the Sweet 16. But back is Corey Davis Jr., who I think, you know, was one of the guys you know, that can really be a breakthrough star for Houston this year. I think he can really fill it up, and without Gray in the mix, is going to be the go-to guy for a team that's going to be pretty guard-heavy this season. So I like Houston. I think Kelvin Sampson's probably not given the credit that he deserves because of the way things ended for him in Indiana, but he's got Houston on a really impressive track right now. They're opening a $60 million arena. There's a lot of buzz around that program, and I think Sampson is adding the pieces there to keep them competitive, even after you know, losing the guys that they lost.
Yeah, the big addition for them, I think, is going to end up being Dejon Giroux, the transfer from Memphis. He was a top 40 player in the class of 2016. And averaged as a freshman in the Atlantic 10 points, 4.5 assists, and 3.5 rebounds. So I do think he's going to step in and kind of help fill the void that Rob Gray is leaving a little bit. And I do think that there is something to the idea that they might like balance in their back. Like they have good guards. They don't have great guards, but they have good guards and a lot of depth in their backcourt. And I think the idea that maybe some of these guys are going to be able to shine a little bit more without Rob Gray dominant, like, don't get me wrong, he was an absolute stud. But without him dominating the ball, I think that some of these guys are going to be able to show what they can do a little bit more. Again, I don't know if I trust their front court, but I don't necessarily know if it matters in this conference. So, yeah, I mean, they're top three in the league. I don't know if they're a tournament team, but I think they are top three in the league. And anything else? I think we can move on.
No, I just, to your point, you know, Rob Gray's usage rates were among, you know, the highest in the country. So getting some balance there is certainly, replacing his production is going to be difficult, but gaining balance is probably the trade-off there.
The key that they're going to have to find to replace him is somebody to get a wild haircut, because if nobody else is going to wear a top knot or a man bun, it's a top knot. Most people call it a man bun. They call it that incorrectly. So if nobody's going to go out and get a top knot, then I think that they're really going to suffer in the haircut department. But that's just me.
There's nobody in the country that is more attuned to the difference between a man bun and a top knot than you. I remember you riding this very hard with Kyle Guy in years past. Like, that's kind of the niche you've carved out for yourself.
It's got a name. Like, that style of haircut has a name, and it just really. I don't know why I get tilted so bad with it. I just get so tilted when people call it a man bun, and it's not a man bun. A man bun is when you don't have the sides and the back shaved. When you have the sides and the back shaved, and you have the ponytail thing up top, then it's called a top knot. And it just, I don't know. I get really tilted by that. I should probably stop caring so much about it.
I mean, or just like have an entire podcast devoted to it.
We've touched it on too many different podcasts. Let's move on. You have Cincinnati at number two. And at this point, I think we all kind of know what we're going to get out of a Mick Cronin team, right? They're going to play tough. They're going to play physical. They're going to grind you down defensively, regardless of who is on the floor. And I do not think that is going to change one iota this season. He's built something in that program. That's what their identity is, and that's what it's going to be again this year. The problem is that last season, they struggled offensively for large stretches of games. They finished 49th nationally in KenPom's adjusted offensive efficiency ranking. And we're looking at this year playing without Gary Clark, playing without Jacob Evans, who is now in the NBA, I believe with the Golden State Warriors, playing without Kyle Washington. That's three of their top four scorers and three of the only guys that I think average more than 4 points a game. So a lot of weight is going to get put on Jerron Cumberland, who you have as the preseason AAC Player of the Year, and Kane Broome in what is going to be a pretty good backcourt. I think we're looking at Trevor Moore and Trey Scott and Keith Williams and Nyzer Brooks. There's going to be a lot of guys in the front court that are going to be asked to take a step forward, and I think that they are going to be able to do that. You know, when you're in Mick Cronin's front court, you basically have to be big, you basically have to be athletic, you basically have to be tough, and you basically have to play your balls off every second that you're on the floor. And if you do all of those things, you are going to have success in the way that he wants to play, and as a result, his teams are going to have success defensively. So I think that it gives them the pieces that they have, I think, gives them a pretty good floor in terms of what their team is going to be this year. I do think they're a tournament team. I don't think they're necessarily a top 25 team, but I think they get back to the big dance. For me, I think the X factor is the JUCO transfer they got, Rashawn Fredericks. He's a highly regarded kid. I think that he played for the U.S. Virgin Islands men's national team this summer. Like, he's a good player. He's played some international basketball, and he like kind of fits their style in terms of what they want to do and who they want to recruit and how they want to play. So I think that he's going to be a big piece, but it also, I think, again, tells you everything you need to know about the AAC, that Cincinnati, despite losing three of their top four scorers from a team that really couldn't score the ball all that well last year, is going to end up being the number two team in this conference. What do you think of Cincinnati?
I mean, I think to talk a little bit more about Cumberland, when I was, you know, kind of going through Cincinnati, and on a much smaller scale than the example I'm going to give, it just reminded me a little bit of Jalen Brunson kind of coming out of the shadows of the guys ahead of him to really take charge of that team that he had last year. And I think on a smaller scale, Cumberland kind of has the tools to do that as the featured player for Cincinnati. And that's why I had him the conference player of the year. And that's a big reason why I have Cincinnati number two, is I just think that that's kind of a tailor-made position for him to kind of step into. And, you know, to your point, I think Mick Cronin knows what he's doing with that front court.
I don't think Jerron Cumberland is going to complain at all about having to take more shots in a basketball game. I think he is one of these players that really, really, really likes to shoot. And now that he's probably going to have to take like 17, 18, 19 shots a game, I think he's going to really, really like that role on this basketball team.
I don't think there's very many guys out there that would not like that opportunity.
Fair enough. All right. Talk to me about UCF and why you think they are going to win the league, and we can get out of here.
Yeah, I like UCF a lot, and it obviously comes with one major caveat that is going to probably be the feature of every single time you see them on television, it will be talked about, and that's their health. Because they are looking at the AAC from top to bottom, I think pretty clearly have the best trio, most talented and most impactful trio in the league in BJ Taylor, Aubrey Dawkins, and Taco Fall. You know, Aubrey Dawkins had some NBA buzz ahead of last year, being Johnny Dawkins, the coach's son, who was previously at Michigan before being lost for the year before the season even started with a torn labrum. I think everybody probably knows Taco Fall's story at this point. The 7'6" shot blocker missed the end of the season because of a shoulder injury. BJ Taylor, probably not as well known, but missed the first couple months, I believe, of last year with a broken foot, but an incredibly talented scorer, 1,000-point scorer. Those three are excellent players. And given that the league is down as a whole, I think that opens the door perfectly for Dawkins' team here. if those three guys can stay healthy. Because if they do, I think that they're talented enough and have enough separation from the rest of the league to be the best team in the AAC this year. But with the injury history, you know, they kind of got to thread the needle and really take advantage of the opportunity ahead of them, you know, and really be all in on getting this done this year, because after that, you know, it's probably back to rebuilding for Johnny Dawkins.
I have never seen a team with a bigger gap between their adjusted offensive and adjusted defensive efficiency rankings on KenPom. They were a top 10 defense last season. They ranked 281st in offensive efficiency. They had they played at like the 330th fastest tempo or something like that. Whatever it was, UCF games last year were more or less unwatchable because of the way that they played. They just wanted to grind the shot clock out. They weren't going to let you get a good look. If you got to the rim, they were probably going to block the shot. If you missed a shot, they were probably going to get the defensive rebound. They were a very, very, very good defensive team, and they could not score at all. And the good news is that with Aubrey Dawkins and B.J. Taylor and Taco Fall coming back, they have their three best scorers, assuming that these guys come back at 100%, back at full health. And I think that's going to change some things for them very much for the positive. I don't see them falling off defensively. I do see them getting to be a much, much better offensive team, much better at scoring. I mean, when you add three guys that can average the, you know, 12 to 17 points a game to your team, then you are just inherently going to be a better offensive team. So I think that they are a borderline top 25 team. I think they are clearly the best team in the AAC. The one thing that I would say is this. Johnny Dawkins has had teams with potential before, right? At Stanford. And he didn't always live up to the potential with those teams. That's kind of one of the reasons that he got in trouble and ended up having to leave that job. So it's going to be interesting to see if this group can live up to those lofty expectations. But I do think it is fair to note that they are kind of flying under the radar nationally. Like, no one is really talking about them all that much. So I don't know if there really is all that much weight of expectation. They should be really good. This is a team that I did an article the other day about the best bets that you can get on teams that are long shots to win the national title and the best futures bets you can get. And you can get UCF right now, who is a borderline top 25 team, who if they hit their ceiling is probably in that top 15 to 20 range. You could get them at plus 50,000 right now, which means that if you bet $1 on them to win the national title, you win $500. If you bet $10 on them right now to win the national title, you win $5,000. And that is unbelievable odds for a team that is as good as they are.
Yeah, I mean, you were making me want to plan a trip to Vegas there real quick with those odds, because if they are healthy, they're going to be really good. And to your point, even adding those guys in, if that hurts them defensively, they can stand to get a little worse defensively, because they have so much ground to make up offensively. It's going to more than offset that, assuming that defense doesn't fall off the cliff. I mean, even if they see a 10 or 15% reduction in their defense, they're going to probably make up for that pretty easily offensively, I would think, by adding Dawkins and Taylor full time. And then, you know, Fall is probably better offensively than he gets credit for. So I think there's a lot to like with this UCF team, even with any potential issues that they might have.
Yeah. And not just in the conference nationally as well. I think that they're kind of being underrated a little bit as a team that's going to be able to make a lot of noise. But Travis, I have kept you here long enough, man. I know you have a child to go take care of. I know you have to go find some more Wizard of Oz shoes in your wall. So I appreciate the time. And if you guys want to follow Travis on Twitter, he is at, what is it again? Travis
Hines 21. 21, yep.
At Travis Hines 21. You want to follow me on Twitter? I am at Rob Doss. Travis, thanks, man. I appreciate it.
Have a good one.